Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning, good morning. This is Jeff Johnson, and this is News One Now. No, I am not Roland Martin. He is on vacation. And if anybody knows Roland, he is probably not eating today. He is going to be turning down his plate. He is going to be in prayer. He is going to be in a major state of meditation because the Texans have lost again. And the Texans didn't just lose. They took on the spirit of the Texas A&M Aggies, allowing the Pittsburgh Steelers to score 24 points in the second quarter, the way that Alabama scored 35 points in the second quarter against the Texas A&M Aggies. So anybody that loves Roland Martin, please reach out to him. He might be on suicide watch. We are praying for him. We are reaching out for him. Roland, we love you, baby. Don't allow your teams to define who you are. Know that those ascots you wear, brother, make you a superhero, even when your teams are absolutely terrible. Getting beat by the terrible Pittsburgh Steelers. Brother, we love you. We love you, Roland. So, I have to take this when I can, because Roland's going to give it to me as soon as the Cowboys lose. But we have a great show today, you all. I am excited that you all are with us this morning. There's a lot going on in the news. We continue to follow Ebola. And there's the newly released guidelines by the CDC, which are focusing on better protecting healthcare workers. More training and supervision are part of the elements. And the CDC, as many of us know, have been under fire for what has happened in Dallas. And the fact that there continue to be nurses that are being treated for Ebola. We also know that, interestingly enough, this what's now being labeled serial killer in Indiana, which is giving remnants of what we saw in Cleveland a little under 2 years ago, where there is a man suspected in the deaths of at least seven women. And it's being expanded to states outside of Indiana and going back decades. And up to this point, Darren Dion Van, and you know, anytime you become a serial killer, you got three names. Darren Dion Van, he's only been charged in the death of 19-year-old Africa Hardy, whose body was found in a Motel 6 in Hammond over the weekend. But they are beginning to connect six other women that have been found there. And the police agencies are now working the case. And it's going to grow larger and expand as this case moves forward. And we're going to talk about that later on today as well. If you didn't know, Monica Lewinsky is now on Twitter. I know you were all waiting for it. You were just saying my Twitter life is just not the way it should be because Monica Lewinsky does not have her Twitter account. Well, everybody, guess what? She is now moving into the space where she says that she was the first person that was abused by social media at a Google conference. I'm sorry, not a Google conference, but a social media, a Forbes 30 Under 30 summit. She talked about the fact that she was one of the first people whose abuse went viral. And while there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there were gossip blogs at the time. And she was one of the first persons to get beat up in that sense. And she wants to be in a place where she can help others with her survivor's tale. She said, and I quote, there was no Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram back then, but there were gossip news and entertainment websites replete with comment sections and emails which could be forwarded. So, yes, she is moving in a new state of ministry, which is to evangelize and save those that are being brutalized over social media. I want you to be a part of our conversation. And I want you to tweet us at Jeff. You can tweet me at Jeff's Nation. You can always, of course, tweet Roland, because even though he's not here, I guarantee you he'll be retweeting folks. And we're going to get into a couple of things today. I want to know, as you all are kind of in your own space, we started early voting yesterday in a number of states. And we have heard over and over again, my good friend Cornell Belcher wrote a great article about the need for turnout in these midterms. And I'm wondering how many of you participated in early vote yesterday? How many of you plan to participate in early voting? And even in the midst of so many activists and civil rights folks rightly complaining about the lack of support from the Supreme Court, the cutting back of early voting in a number of states, Texas moving forward with their voter ID laws that in many cases get in the way of some poor people and people of color getting to the polls. I want to know if you're early voting. I want to know why you're early voting. I want to know how your early voting experience has gone. And I also want to know, in your own families, are you all talking about the election? Or are you getting excited about it? I know for some of you, especially because you listen to this show, you may be. But I'd like to know where you and your families are. I know that even in seeing President Obama going out with Lieutenant Governor Brown this weekend to stump for him, and seeing only a third of the way through the speech, people beginning to leave. Because in some cases, I think people are just looking to be politically entertained versus politically educated. I'm questioning how mature some of our electorate is, and I'm interested in knowing what issues you know about, what issues you don't know about. I'm going to pull up some, but we're going to get all up into it. And so I want to hear from you all. Are you early voting? Why are you early voting? What are the issues that you most care about? Are people around you excited about it, or are you having to beat people over the head with it? This is News One Now. I am Jeff Johnson, filling in for the pained and struggling, emotionally distraught Roland Martin. You all will be right back after this. It's 7 after the hour.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Hey, welcome back, you all. This is Jeff Johnson filling in for Roland Martin, and this is News One Now. It is 13 after the hour, and we got a lot to talk about, but we are joined this morning by Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., who is calling us from South Africa, where he is being honored, but where I know a number of leaders are there to talk about a number of issues, especially around issues of faith. And so, Reverend Jackson, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Good morning, Jeff. We're here in Mandela Bay, South Africa, formerly Port Elizabeth. Elizabeth is not coming back. It's no longer Port Elizabeth, and Mandela is not leaving. So it's now Mandela Bay. And what a joy it is for people to have the power to change these names as they change their minds. I'm giving the Governor Mbeki lecture tonight here in Mandela Bay, South Africa. But a lot of folks here are moving from freedom to equality. They're not free, but you're not free if you have disparities in health care and jobs and houses and banking and transportation and agriculture. It's what we are. Free but not equal. So the one layer of the struggle has been achieved, but there's work to be done. And I must say, they're fast at work here. There are more houses being built. There's more drinkable water developed. And so I would say that there are a lot of challenges here, but you'll be proud of the progress I think they're making in South Africa.
That's good to hear. And with that, even before we start talking about a couple of these issues, I mean, there's been so much criticism, I guess, over the last decade about how slowly there's been transfer of wealth and resources. Do you think that the country is in a place where you're beginning to see shifts in wealth, where those that were on the bottom rung or are at least being seen opportunity that perhaps...
Well, they are politically free, but just as wealth has not been shifting out, which is not being shifted here in the dramatic way.
Mm-hmm.
We are so free, we have a president, but the gap between the have and the have-nots has gotten greater.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer and fewer have more and more have less and less. That's a challenge here as well, but they have the power to begin to amend their constitution to have new formulas for greater wealth distribution, particularly as it affects people at the bottom up, not just the top down. I also want to say people have been here free for 20 years. This is the 20th year of their freedom. At 20 years, of age, America was just gearing up for 246 years of slave trade. After 346 years, we were just ending Jim Crow with the right to vote. So they are making progress against great odds. But in the deal they cut, it was political freedom. It was not a major adjustment in wealth sharing. But that is simply more people working, doing with more dreams than they had 20 years ago. You have political apartheid, that's over. You have economic apartheid, as we do at home, healthcare apartheid, education apartheid. Apartheid is not just skin deep, it's also bone marrow deep. Mm. They got to cut through several fathoms to get to the bottom of the system here, and as we do at home.
Well, let me ask you this, Reverend, because as you well know, all over the country, we're talking about Ebola. We're talking about the panic that many people have because they don't understand it. We're talking about the CDC's regulations that were just released that are supposed to provide guidelines to local healthcare officials. And in many cases, we even talked yesterday about is there a overplay from the media focusing on the sensationalism around the Ebola virus and not really dealing with the facts.
Let's put it this way. Where there is health infrastructure, it's being conquered. Nigeria just came off the list. One-fourth of all Africans are Nigerian. Senegal just came off of the list. Now, what the soldiers are doing in Liberia, Kenya, and Sierra Leone is building these tents, temporary tents for health, which means that hospitals and the nurses and they need guns and soldiers. Yet, reason because we have infrastructure.
I'm losing you a little bit there, Rev. Can you hear me? We're going to see if we can get Rev back on the line. I mean, we know he's calling from South Africa, so sometimes the connection there is we got bad connection sometimes calling from Southwest D.C. So we know that calling from South Africa is challenging. Rev, can you hear me? Okay. Well, we'll see what we can do. And as he started talking about just the need for infrastructure, and for some of you that hadn't heard, he started to talk about the fact that Nigeria has announced that they are Ebola free. I don't know how they can exactly say that they're Ebola free when they haven't tested everybody in the country for Ebola. But I think that clearly, to Rev's point, Nigeria has created infrastructure. There is training that is taking place amongst healthcare officials. They know what they're looking for. They're treating they have treated people when it was necessary. And I think, and I can't verify this, but there is some level of monitoring at various borders and intake, obviously, when people are flying into the country. So that is something that the United States just was not prepared for, as I think several of our guests talked about yesterday. And I hope that we can get Reverend back, as there is a lot more that we'd love to talk to him about. I know that he was interested in talking about this issue with Venus and Serena and the constant kind of bashing that they've received, as well as voting. And again, I'm interested in knowing for you all if you have early voted. A couple of you have tweeted me saying that you did early vote yesterday and that you're looking to. We got Reverend Jackson back. We're going to take this break, come back and get into it heavy with the Reverend from South Africa. Stay tuned. This is News One Now. And I am Jeff Johnson. See you back.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, this is Jeff Johnson, and you're listening to News One Now. I'm filling in for Roland Martin. And on the phone right now is Reverend Jesse Jackson, Sr., calling in from Mandela Bay in South Africa. And Reverend Jackson, you're beginning to talk about the spaces where there is infrastructure, where we're seeing a difference. And you started talking
about... People survived.
Yes.
One person survived, was died in America, and that's because the infrastructure was not applied. But in the case of Duncan, the three protocols, one is a diagnosis of a blood test. That did not happen. Observation, somebody come from West Africa, vomiting with a fever, that was ignored. And three, quick and safe treatment, that did not happen. I think, among other things, he was blacking in the half health insurance, was routinely turned away. He came with Ebola, he left with Ebola. Mm-hmm. He came back with the worst case of Ebola. Those handling him, because he'd been misdiagnosed, got sick. But because they had the best of medical care in America, they are now getting well, which means that we need not panic. Our third world allies need medical infrastructure. Liberia, let us not forget, every 5-stone tire in your on your car came from the rubber fields of Liberia. Mm-hmm. Most of America was in Liberia. America's military outpost in World War II and from Africa was in Liberia. Liberia is a creditor. We are the debtor. We cannot walk away from Liberia for all the right reasons. Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone matter very much to us. We can contain and wipe out Ebola without being wiped out in the process. And for the Christians who push them off, let me tell you, in the biblical times, unclean was at the people with leprosy. And push them away, let them die. Jesus went behind the quarantine shelter of Simon the leper, stayed with him all night long to embrace the leper but reject the leprosy. That's the moral obligation we have to address the issue. Don't want some people who are sick and dying.
Well, let me ask you this, Rev. Are we? How do we keep our eye on continuing to turn the needle on Ebola in Africa when we've got so many people who are dealing with lack of information here? Does the presence of Ebola in the United States help our need to be able to create the infrastructure that doesn't exist in Africa, or does it get in the way?
I think sometimes the media is flaming the fan in America. For example, the same like you take a guy like Perry, who turns out $100 billion in Medicaid money for the poor. It's talking about we need more borders. The fact is, the poorest people in America are dying not just from Ebola. Almost nobody dying from Ebola comparatively. Mm-hmm. It's weakened flu and pneumonia, and cancer and diabetes. So we have some unfinished business in our own country. That's a self-inflicted wound. We should be fighting from Virginia around to Texas. They rejected outright free Medicaid money. They should not be allowed to do it. And our vote movement, of course, should be about fighting for Medicaid for the poorest Americans. That is the way out of poverty. Without medical care, when you get sick, there's no end to the number of people who get trapped in bankruptcy because they can't survive.
Well, let's talk about the state of Texas, and we all know that over the weekend we saw the Supreme Court rule to allow additional voter requirements in Texas, and we know that we're seeing the same thing happen in other states. We're seeing early voting removed. This is not new. And as you well know, while the Supreme Court, I think, is wrong and some of these state legislatures are wrong, what are the things that we can do in the midst of their insanity, if you will, to be able to make sure that the folks that we need to get to the polls get to the polls in lieu of bad policy?
It's the reason why we need a constitutional amendment for the protected right to vote. The states' rights movement is now and a major backlash to undermine the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was a state's right in 1965, and Congress moved to stamp it out, but they've come back full swing again. States' rights are very dangerous to us. States' rights in health care and in voting and access to wages, and that's kind of the fight they're fighting. In the meantime, use the means that we do have. It may be early voting, or it may be overwhelming the system with our votes, but know that the Supreme Court, there are no narrowly applied Supreme Court systems. So if it applies to Texas, it's going to apply across the country.
Yep.
They're going to weaken the voting rights around the country. But we must strengthen our resolve to vote in spite of that. They're going to keep on shooting down people unless we keep on fighting back. And let me say, Jeff, I know your time is precious. What happened to Serena and Venus Williams was more than racist or sexist. It was vile. I mean, I could hot as a pot of pepper pudding. I could have set ice on fire on my head with a cigarette butt and light up a river for that man to be so racist and so sexist to call these two beautiful, brilliant women men. He should be banned for a long time.
Well, and for those, and Reverend, for those that didn't know, because I know that sometimes some of this information is missed on us, that there was a Russian Tennis Federation, the president of the Russian Tennis Federation called the Williams sisters the Williams brothers. And obviously it was not a mistake. It was an intentional gaffe. And so he's apologized.
That's kind of backroom talk that came out. These women with muscles, they must be men. They're brothers, not sisters. And he said it. And in fact, it paid a price. But we should get the number, Jeff, of the World Tennis Association and the U.S. Tennis Association and fill up their lines and tweets and Instagram, whatever we can use, Facebook. We must challenge the WTA and UST to not let him back in until after a real hearing, because you can't get much more violent than that to call two women men.
He went on, Rev, to say that they were scary to look at. So it was even beyond calling them brothers. He said that they were scary to look at. And the maximum fine.
Well, I mean, that's the guy with that, the MSNBC, what's his name, the morning disc jockey. About the girls at Rutgers had that pay and all that stuff. It's more, I mean, some people are shooting in the back. Some are shooting in the front and defending themselves. Some are name calling. That's the meanest. That's why in 60, in 08, we were not beyond racism. We outvoted them. We beat them down. And we must be long distance runners. In other words, race didn't change, but the 65 Voting Rights Act gave us blacks could vote, women could vote, serve on juries, teenagers could vote at age 18, you could vote on college campuses, you could vote bilingually. We beat them. They didn't concede. We beat them. Unless if we keep fighting, we'll keep beating them. Our only way to win is to beat them November the 4th. This is just that high.
Absolutely. Well, Rev, we so appreciate you calling in, especially overseas. Know that you're running like crazy, and I'm almost positive you and I will bump into each other at some point on the ground in between now and November 4th.
Well, it'll be real soon. We're going to fight with our sister up in Ohio to win that Secretary of State position.
Yes, sir.
We can win that. We vote our numbers and not our fears. And tweet me at Rev J. Jackson, at Rev J. Jackson on Facebook. Like me on Reverend Jesse L. Jackson Sr. And let's stay in touch and connect and make things happen. Do it all. November 4th is a big day. You may have missed August 28, 1963, but don't miss 2014. We have the power, but we have the will to fight back.
There it is. Thank you, Reverend. Be safe.
Love you, buddy.
That's Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. calling from Mandela Bay in South Africa, talking about more in 10 minutes than most people talk about all day. This is Jeff Johnson filling in for Roland Martin. It's 33 after the hour. We are going to be right back with more of you. You can call in and be a part of the conversation at 877-373-9766. We'll be right back.
Hey, you might want to keep this number handy. 877-373-9766. That's 877-373-9766. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, this is Jeff Johnson back for Roland Martin. This is News One Now. And just had a great conversation with Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., who has always ended the call talking about how important November 4th is. And on November 4th, as most of you know, if you listen to this show, is that it is Election Day. And there are members of Congress, members of the Senate, in a few states there will be governors, in many states there will be state elected officials, everything from governor down to Secretary of State and Attorney Generals, that will be selected and will be elected by the people. We understand that in 2010, 19 million people came out and voted in early voting. And there are some that are projecting that early voting will be higher than that. The question is who? Typically, early voting has been utilized by those that tend to lean left and vote Democratic. But the Republican Party has done a massive outreach in seeing that their supporters also utilize early voting. So it's going to be very interesting to see in key states like North Carolina and Georgia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, how many people come out to early vote, especially in states where early voting has been reduced and almost removed. And as we see states like Ohio that is almost totally removed early voting on Sundays, which really has been a mobilization tool for the faith community and thus communities of color, how that will affect the early voting numbers. You've got folks in Ohio that are looking to remedy that. You've got folks in North Carolina that are looking to utilize faith communities and other communities of color to be able to mobilize folks. But the question is, will it work? And when all is said and done, whether you trust the system or don't trust the system, if we don't vote, we definitely leave our destiny in the hands of someone else. Let me know what your thoughts are. You can be a part of the conversation at 877-373-9766. I have not yet voted and am planning to early vote in the state of Maryland, which doesn't really have a whole lot of issues with being able to go vote early, finding enough polling stations, being able to be actively engaged. But we do know in my home state of Ohio that I'm heading to this week to be able to mobilize folks, they have a ton of challenges. So I want to be able to see where you all are. Again, 877-373-9766 is the number. I cannot see the list right now, but do we have a caller on the line? Wonderful. That means y'all need to call. Again, 877-373-9766. What's interesting to me is that we have, and I think that as an electorate, we need to talk about this more often. There's a ton of money that is poured into every presidential cycle. And whether it's coming from political action committees, super PACs that we know them by these days on both sides of the aisle, whether they're coming from unions or whether they are coming from money from wealthy donors, we understand that the money that goes into presidential campaigns is unmatched by almost any other democratic process anywhere in the world. On the flip side, as we've heard people talk about in Ferguson over and over again, during local elections and midterm elections, we almost see single-digit numbers of turnout in certain parts of the country. And so we saw less than 10% turnout in Ferguson, but Ferguson wasn't the only one. There, even in New York City, in cities like Baltimore, in cities like Philly, we see incredibly low turnout for local mayoral and city council, school board elections, judicial races, and we see less than high turnout in midterm elections, which drastically affects our quality of life. I think, as you heard from Reverend Jackson even this morning, that state policy and state politics, states' rights, in many cases, is the modus operandi, especially of the Republican Party, where they are working diligently to ensure that states have more authority, that Republican-controlled state legislatures have the ability to cast law that supersedes that or outside of that of the federal government, and are willing to take these cases to court to be able to ensure that the precedent that they set through their state legislatures is held up in court, even by the Supreme Court of the land. And so that says that we have to fight a little bit differently. I think that we need to talk a little bit later about the debate around whether voting rights should be focused on at the federal level. I don't know if we need another Voting Rights Act, and I know that that will upset some of the folks that I fight with on the civil rights level, but we need to fight where we are. And the real battle is at the state level. And we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, I think is more what I'm talking about. Let me hear from you all. 877-373-9766 is the number. It's 43 minutes after the hour. This is News One Now. I am Jeff Johnson, filling in for Roland Martin. Stay tuned. We'll be right back, y'all.
The phone lines are open at 877-373-9766.
Don't mess with me on this topic now.
That's 877-373-9766. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
What's up, y'all? This is Jeff. I am filling in for Roland, who is not here today, who's on a well-deserved vacation. And we are talking about this election that is coming up on November 4th. I asked if anybody out there had early voted. Tell me about your experience, what we are looking to do, how we can be helpful, what kind of resources you can use. But what I'm also interested in, is those of you that are just saying, you know what, Jeff, because there was somebody that tweeted me and Roland maybe a week ago saying, I'm tired of y'all talking about voting. You know this thing doesn't work. I'm not voting. Stop talking about it. And this brother wasn't the only person that feels that way. So I want to know if you are just saying, look, I'm not voting, and you're not ashamed to say it. I want to hear from you, 877-373-9766. If you're just saying, look, I am not going to vote, it doesn't matter what you say. I don't think it works. I don't think it's something that we need to be involved in. We're wasting our time. There's more that we can do. If that's you, I want to hear from you. No judgment, just understanding. Let me hear from you. Tell me about what you're thinking, why you're thinking it. Maybe we can meet in the middle somewhere. I've got Demetrius on the line, who is calling in from Cleveland around taking away the right to vote. Demetrius, what you thinking, man?
Yeah, I was thinking, after Reconstruction, after the Civil War, you had a lot of African Americans who participated in the legislature, elected governors and congressmen, and so the. So people want to take power back over the plantation owners. You know, they pretty much used the same tactics was being used today. You know, they came up with ways, besides setting up the Ku Klux Klan, they set up the grandfather clause and
poll taxes, right.
Yeah, and so forth. And it's going on today when they set up ways to make it more difficult, you know, for black people to vote. So America haven't came far when it comes to trying to equalize, make equal for African Americans to vote, because the ones who's in power who feel like they're losing their economic, you know, superiority, you know, and when a person can vote, you know, they have a lot of say so where money is being allocated to those who have less advantage, or those who not less advantage, who just want more money for themselves. Because you have people who grew up in the South, even up here in North, even years ago, you had welfare and different programs, but they wasn't getting money. The black farmers wasn't getting money for their farms, getting subsidies, where you had the white farmers were getting money. So the same process going on today, that's why it's important to vote for the congressman. And also concerning police brutality or other issues concerning the streets, it's important to vote for attorney generals and also for secretary of state. And even when it comes to the local elections, when it comes to county commissioners, so to make sure that the streets are being protected by individuals who care about the community and not just there for a paycheck. And also when you brought up the issue about some people might not want to vote this time around, I think some people are looking for a candidate who's not a politician, who's not willing to compromise for the right thing just to get some issues passed. Because they came out for Barack Obama. You know, the country was in a deep recession. And so they, both black and white people, are looking for someone to help them stay on their job or make their life easier. But it is a political office, and President Obama, a politician, something he wasn't able to do without trading off on some issues.
Well, and all politics is about, in many cases, is trading off, right? I mean, the whole notion of the system is about, how do I help you for you to help me over here? There very seldom is an all or nothing kind of game, regardless of what we see some of these politicians playing in Congress right now. What I'm interested in knowing from you, though, brother, is, you know, you talked about people wanting to see a certain kind of elected official, but we don't see people investing in campaigns. And so you and I both know there have been more than a few young people that have attempted to run for city council, for school board in the city of Cleveland. And whether it's Bashir Jones or whether it's somebody else, you know, these folks aren't necessarily getting broad-based support, whether it's folks writing $5, $10 checks or whether it's coming out to volunteer. So when you don't get a politician, somebody who's in that space where they aren't necessarily all the way bought into the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, we don't always see people support them. Why do you think that's the case?
I believe, you know, some people, they don't support them because it's a feeling that they would not be heard or would not be taken seriously. A lot of people lost faith in the political system in the sense they feel like they look down to less able to understand what's going on in the political system once someone is elected or they have faith in a politician. Seems like most politicians feel like they're superior in knowing how to run the country than the ones who they're representing.
So it almost seems like a double-edged sword. On one end, mm-hmm. we got folks that are all the way bought in. On the other end, we got mm-hmm. folks that may not be taken seriously. I mean, it sounds to me like, and Demetrius, I really appreciate your call this morning, brother. Like we really are in a place where we've got to figure out how to build up new candidates, create candidate incubators, making sure that we're training people to understand what public service is. And that's not easy, y'all, but it's something that we got to talk more about. It's 6 minutes until the top of the hour. If you got to be there by the top of the hour, you better hurry up. This is Jeff Nation. I am filling in for Roland Martin. Hit me on Jeff's Nation. Let me know what you're thinking, or you can call in. We're going to be right back, you all. This is News One Now.
So I guess you're enjoying the conversation. Well, join in by calling 877-373-9766. That's 877-373-9766. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, this is Jeff Johnson, and I am filling in for Roland Martin, who's out on vacation, you all. It's right after the top of the hour, and we are talking about voting. Are you early voting? Are you not voting? What is the most important issue for you around this midterm election? We've got Tripp calling in from Atlanta, Georgia. Tripp, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can, sir. What's on your mind?
Not much. I am not voting.
And you are not voting.
And I'm not afraid to admit it.
Well,
want to know why I'm not voting? I'm gonna give you a little history. I'm gonna give you a little history about my background first.
Okay.
So before I get blasted.
No, I wasn't gonna blast you. I was just gonna ask you why.
No, I'm not. Before anybody else blasts me.
Okay.
I'm 37, mm-hmm. black male. I live in America. I'm former military. I got a college education. My mother was a cop. And I don't see anybody campaigning on police brutality. Or stopping it. So there's no vote in the world that's going to stop a cop's bullet. This system was not made for us, black people. And you can vote all you want, you're going to still gun people down in the street. And that's a fact. Because the police unions control everything. They control a lot of the people who's putting on these ballots. Not all of the candidates, but a lot of them, especially in these little rural areas like Ferguson or a small city like mine, Smyrna, I don't think it's nowhere near as bad as Ferguson. Jesus, those cops have got to be the worst cops in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not voting. There's nobody campaigning on stopping police brutality. I am just not voting at all.
Well, here's the deal, right? And I'm not angry with you. I mean, like I said, when I asked people to call in and say that they were not voting, I said no judgment. But I think that there's a way that the system works and there's a way that it doesn't. We all know that it's flawed. We also know that in many cases the system was never created to empower the disenfranchised. We've seen disenfranchised be able to hijack it in some cases and be able to use it to their benefit in ways it was never intended. In what I believe was never intended by the founding fathers. But you and I both know, brother, that politicians in many cases only campaign on what they see the people raising hell about. And so in most cities outside of St. Louis in 2014, there is not a legitimate mobilization around what policy looks like for police brutality. Whether it's in Cleveland that had officers shoot 137 bullets into a car, or whether it is in Georgia, or whether it's in Florida, for that matter, there is not a sustained movement of individuals that says, wait a minute, y'all, in every single city in the country, we only want city council people that will vote to ensure that there's a civilian review board that has subpoena power. At every single state legislature, we only want to see state elected officials that say that there will be a state review board for police misconduct. For every single member of Congress that's running, we want you to ensure that if there are several violations of police misconduct, then we begin to withhold the Department of Justice dollars from local police departments, and you have no access to federal aid. So to your point, until you have a group of citizens that's mobilizing to make that a legitimate agenda, you're not going to have a whole lot of politicians campaigning on it. Because there's
right. Because
there's no will. So the question that I ask you is, even if you believe in 2014 that is your issue, right? That's the only issue that you care about right now, that's the reason why you are not voting. The onus then ultimately comes back on us that says, okay, what are we going to do to begin to create the ecosystem that pushes elected officials and reminding ourselves, wait a minute, elected officials work for me. They run to get my vote. And after they get my vote, I'm the one that has to hold them accountable or not hold them accountable. So I'm not mad at you, brother. I do, however, think that there are more than just police brutality issues that are at stake here, and that you may be playing yourself a little bit short by saying, look, I don't see any of these candidates that are supporting the issue I care about the most. But you and I both know that those people that get elected to office are going to be making decisions on a whole litmus of issues that are going to affect your life and the life of your family. So I think it's challenging, man, when we accept the fact that it's a flawed system, when we accept the fact that in most cases it wasn't built for us, when we accept the fact that most of the people running end up being a selection of the lesser of two evils versus somebody I'm actually excited about. And with all of those realities, it's like, damn, and you want me to vote in the midst of this? Well, yeah. Because those lesser of two evils are going to determine what education looks like. They're going to determine, are we using Common Core? Are we not using Common Core? They're going to determine what the police that we already dislike are going to be able to have more or less power to do. All of those things are going to happen, brother, whether we vote or not. And so I'd rather be in the number that said, even if I lost the battle, I at least swung. Like they didn't hit me in my face without me trying to swing back. So that's. Again, there's no judgment for me, brother. I think that it makes more sense to vote, but I think I understand the reason why you say that you're not.
Let me, if I have a chance, let me throw this in there. I'm an independent contractor, so meaning I get a lot of customers and I go work on this stuff randomly to make money. Earlier this year, I was out. I do a lot of things. I work on cars, a lot of stuff. But anyway, I was out working on a car, and I had a idea.
Well, I want you, Trip. I want you to hold that because I got to take a break. But when we come back, I want you to tell me about that idea, and then I've got some other people on hold that I want to get to you all. You all can also be a part of this conversation by dialing 877-373-9766. This is Jeff Johnson. This is News One Now. It's 7 after the hour. We're going to be right back.
Get ready. Get ready. Get ready to enjoy your early morning cup of coffee and lots of conversation with Roland Martin.
My name is Elder Cal Morrell, and they call me the Happy Preacher.
All right.
Listen, man, you have got my attention. I have given up Good Morning America just for you.
All right. I like that.
And you so interesting in, man, you beat that man like he had stole something this morning. and you are the man.
Yes, we are your centerpiece for Black Thoughts in America. Welcome to News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Hey, y'all, this is Jeff Johnson back for Roland Martin. This is News One Now. And we are talking about voting. We are talking about it heavy. We are talking about it hard. And I need you all to make sure that you are. Can you hear me? There we go. There it is. Jeff did not have his mic close enough for y'all to be able to hear me the way that I need to. I got Tripp on the line who was talking about getting ready to go into a story. So, Tripp, why don't you head into your story?
Yeah, so anyway, I was out working on this customer's car, and it was in a pretty nice area. Some condos, you know, kind of mixed. And I was in a group, like, this was in the daytime. This was playing at daylight out there. It was earlier this year. So I was down there working on the car, and there's plenty of people going and coming and going about their business. But this one person kind of stopped me from what I'm doing. It was, like, about 20, 30 feet away. I was in the trunk of this car putting a fuel pump in there. So he says, can I help you? I said, yeah, you can help me get this fuel pump out of this car. I was like that. He said, well, you know, is this your car? I said, no, this is my customer's car. I'm working on it for him. So he said, well, we've had some break-ins here lately, that thing. I said, well, I'm working on my customer's car. If you want, I can call him. He said, no, that's okay. So it goes in the elevator and goes upstairs. And I said, he's going to call the cops. And not 5 seconds later, about 10 police swarmed me, drew their guns, and it was just a bad situation all the way around. So one of the cops asked me, you know, what was I doing, all that stuff. I explained to him. He said, well, I told him I can call my customer now. I said, my phone's in my car. He said, okay, go get it. Here's where stuff gets dicey. It's right as I'm about to reach in the car. I'm not saying I don't do that. Now, if I had reached in that car, it would have blew my brains out and made up any kind of story.
And we've seen it happen.
Yeah. And look, I was literally like 1 second away from reaching that car. There's cops around me everywhere with their guns all over the place. And see, here's the catch-22 about this. I don't reach in the car, of course, because I'm older and I know better. But here's the thing. He offers to go into my car and get the gun. So now, either way, I'm screwed up. Either I reach in the car and I get shot, or I let him go in there and just visibly look around in my car for no reason.
Well, and again, to your point, there's a couple of things that have to happen. Number one, we've got to help train young people in particular, but everybody, what their rights are as it relates to the police, how we engage with the police. The ACLU has done that for a long time in putting together pieces of information that people can carry around with them so that they know what their rights are with the police. But you and I both know this is not something that changes overnight. You can have the best mayor, the best police chief, great police officers, and that doesn't mean that you won't have one bad apple, if not more than that, within a department. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and we can either decide to do it or not. Tripp, I appreciate your call. Freedom, I want to get you in on this conversation real quickly. I got a quick minute before I got to go to break. What's on your mind?
Oh, man, a minute. I run my mouth. I can't say nothing in a minute, but I try. I tell you what.
Yeah, well, why don't you start?
Okay. The quality of politicians, candidates that mm-hmm. we always have, you know, to vote for is one thing. I think we have to explore that right there. The other thing is the idea of voting itself. What it does is it legitimizes the system. It's a rigged system, and being rigged, and when we participate, the things that we get are nothing compared to what, if the system wasn't rigged, what we should be getting. Well, let me put it this way. When you get certain concessions through voting,
right?
Those concessions are well thought out. You know, I remember I think it was Theodore Roosevelt, and probably a little bit after that, when the Congress and whatnot began to realize that.
Well, let me do this, brother, because I see you going. I'm gonna take a break really quickly, and I'm gonna come right back to you. This is News One Now. You all is 20 after the hour. We will be right back.
Hey, you might want to keep this number handy. 877-373-9766. That's 877-373-9766. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, it's 25 after the hour. This is Jeff Johnson. You're listening to News One Now, and we're talking about voting, early voting, why we don't vote, what the challenges with the system are, and we've got Freedom on the line from Washington, D.C. Brother, you were starting to talk a little bit about some of your concerns. Why don't you go ahead and finish?
Okay. Yeah, I was just trying to just point out the fact that we're doing something every time we vote, which is legitimize the system. That in and of itself it should be enough for us to realize, I think, that we probably want to step back from voting alone. Well, voting as a primary way of advancing our causes, because when you legitimize the system, you're saying to the system that it's okay for you to do everything you're doing to us, to kill us in the street, to take away our educational rights, our right to sovereignty, our right to, you know, every human concern that we have. You're taking that away, but we're okay with it, so we're going to vote.
Help me understand that what not voting in that scenario does.
Well, when you, let's say, for example, if every every black and brown person in this country refuses to vote, refuses to legitimize the system would have to then deal with us on another level.
Why would it? Because right? at the end of the day, what makes a democracy is the ability not to vote. And so if you decide not to vote, that is a choice within a democracy that says you don't want to be part of the process, even if the process works.
Right. Right. So
the powers that be aren't all of a sudden going to say, oh, my God, black and brown people aren't voting. Let's change stuff. They're going to say, great.
No, they're not part of the process. I didn't suggest that the powers that be were going to suddenly say, let's change stuff. I said when. Help me understand.
So my question to you then, brother, is what is the value in us not voting?
Right. Let me get to that. The value of us not voting as a collective, if that were to be, if that could happen today, what we would do is then force the system to have to deal with us on another level, which means that we would then be able to take, obviously, our financial ability to hurt the system and wield that against the system.
But can't then you do that while you can't walk and chew gum at the same time?
Well,
all the stuff you're talking about can still be done while you're voting.
While you're voting, you're actually legitimizing the fact that they can kill your babies.
You're attempting to get somebody into office that doesn't do that. While you're voting, you're attempting to hold somebody accountable whose policies operate in opposition to you. Let me ask you this, brother. Do you have a 9-to-5 job?
Yeah, definitely. My God, that's one of the principles of capitalism.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Do you believe you get paid enough?
Well, I mean,
let me ask you a question. Do you believe you get paid enough? Do you get paid enough to do what you do?
You're
validating the system, brother, by keep going to work.
Yes, sir. And that's my point. That's exactly my point.
So stop going to work, brother.
Wait, hold on. Don't get attack me personally.
I'm not attacking you at all. And I apologize if that's how it's coming out. But what I am saying to you is that's the same logic that you're using.
Well, I'm trying to deal with that. The logic you're dealing with. Okay, for one, when you as a group legitimize a system, right? You're telling the next generation that this is the only way you have to deal with your concerns, and it's not. It's obviously not. We all know that's not the only way, voting, right? We can agree on that.
Right, we agree.
What I'm saying is that to move further in that part of the discussion, we have to begin to realize that if we delegitimize the system, if we do not vote, and if we do that seriously, what we then can move to is another way for them to deal with us, which is financially. We can do that simultaneously, yes, but it's not happening because we lean too much on voting, and we voting for politicians whose character, whose mental ability to get in the system and deal with it, they sell out because why? There's money involved.
Right, and there's money involved, and we're not writing checks. So we got a trillion. So African Americans have $1 trillion in spending power, but how many of them write checks to a political campaign? They got $1 trillion in spending power.
Remember, our spending power doesn't match the corporate power.
I'm not talking about what it matches, brother. I'm talking about the fact you got it.
So if you've got
$1 trillion in spending power, but you don't use it for political infrastructure, and then you say political infrastructure doesn't work for you, whose fault is that?
Let me explain that. Now, see, that's the point. We've gone for years thinking that black folks are at fault for not voting, black folks are or black and brown folk are at fault for not being politically savvy. Here's the problem. The system, and I mentioned this point to some folk yesterday, the system, whenever we get power, if we ever get power, we did in the late 1800s, you know, coming out of slavery. We had the Congress sold up and everything. The system is designed for white folks or power, white power, to come back and take that from us. Now, the reason why they can do that is because they have what? The guns, the majority numbers, and the wealth and the money to do so.
So how do we explain D.C. that had all African-American political power, Atlanta that had all African-American political power, several other cities that have almost all African-American political power? So while I am not in any way, shape, or form, brother, trying to say that as African-American people or disenfranchised people, that the deck's not stacked against us. Nor am I disagreeing.
I hear you. Listen. I hear you clearly. I don't think you're saying that at all. I think you're very cogent and clear on what you're saying. But what I'm saying to you and to us as a people is that we have to stop doing the same thing and expecting different results.
Well, brother, we agree on that.
Black people in D.C. lost power primarily because of what I just stated. Because white folks, white power has the ability, the wealth, the numbers, and everything to come in and to upset what black folk have in any major city in this country.
Well,
and
brother,
we don't want to.
Freedom, I unbelievably appreciate your feedback and making us think a little bit. I do agree with you as it relates to this notion that we got to start doing some things differently. That the vote is really just one weapon in the arsenal that we have, and if we don't actively and effectively and aggressively use those things that you talked about, whether it's the economic piece or other weapons that we have, then in short sale, we're just saying, hey, we're going to vote, but we're not going to do anything else. Brother Wilson is on the line from Cincinnati. Brother Wilson, what's on your mind, sir?
I would like to first say that are you doing a fine job in your substitution for today?
Well, I appreciate Brother Wilson. I apologize, man. I brought you on right at a time that we have to take a break. Please stay right there. As soon as we come back from the break, I'm going to come right to you. Y'all, this is Jeff Johnson filling in for Roland Martin. This is News One Now. We will be right back. It is 32 minutes after the hour. If you got to get there, you got about 28 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll see you soon.
The phone lines are open at 877-373-9766.
Don't mess with me on this topic now.
That's 877-373-9766. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, this is Jeff Johnson. This is News One Now. We are talking about voting, and Brother Wilson from Cincinnati was beginning to make his remarks. Brother Wilson, what's on your mind, sir?
I was just I was listening, the last brother had some decent things to say. If you're gonna talk about voting, I do believe just for the simple fact of what everybody did prior to us being here, the sacrifice to voters, it has to have something to be useful or value to a people. So I would say you should vote. But it's just like I don't think we vote right and like in a right way.
So what does voting right look like to you?
I remember when I was I seen a case that the Democratic Party got together and they had a group of people vote. The Republican Party, they had a group of Republicans vote Democratic to specifically get a woman out of her seat on the Senate. I think it's Ms. McKinney. They conspired together and did it. So I don't think I don't think people as a whole do it on a scale to really make a difference. You know, I really don't believe that either party is useful for the people. I believe they're both corrupted and serve to the Congress, and that's corrupted. You know, I mean, I believe that the government as a whole is not designed to help the people. You know, it's a lot of loopholes and things that you can do.
The government is designed for the people to force elected officials to do what they want them to do.
I mean, yeah, and that's what it sounds. It sounds good. It really does. You know. But society as a whole, as we're going right now, if the people do not unite and get right, we won't do anything. You know what I mean? The first thing they did, they separated us. You know what I mean? They kind of broke us down into each individualized groups, and so when they did that, we weren't as strong as we were. You know, so that's the first thing you do to conquer people is you got to divide them.
Well, the first thing you do to conquer people is you ensure they're not educated.
That's true too. And you know, we ain't been educated. I also know
that we've stopped educating each other to the degree that we should.
That's right. And
I'm not one of these people that blame black people for all their problems. I'm not on
right.
that
well,
at all.
It's even bigger than just black and white. You know, it's
agreed.
It's a lot of mirage, a lot of deception going on in the government. There's a lot of things going on in this world that people ain't aware of what's going on.
Yeah, but you and I both know, man. Whether it's brothers on the street or whether it's brothers in that are intellectual, we always talking about being up on the game, and it's a game. And let's play it like it's a game. So the issue is that we don't have to sit back and say, oh, my God, the U.S. system of democracy is one of the best in the world and it's designed to treat all people fairly. It's, look, here's how the system works. It's fueled by these dollars. Well, we have dollars. Let's effectively utilize these dollars to play the game that we want to. It's moved by an agenda. People that have an agenda that are aggressive with it, that raise hell and that shout from the streets and that do sophisticated mobilization, that do lobbying, get their issues addressed. The people that complain about the man got the best of me and the system don't work are the people that don't get their issues addressed. And so we can either be sophisticated within this game that exists the way it is, or we can complain about it and still not get what we need. And my thing is, I would rather go hard in an imperfect system that I know isn't designed to necessarily do everything I want it to and try to manipulate it the way it's trying to manipulate me than go out like what I think is a sucker and sit there and say, oh, my God, it doesn't affect me. I hate it. It wasn't designed to serve me. And then every time I go to work and I don't have a livable wage, it's because I wasn't mobilizing to get the minimum wage raise. Every time I go and deal with the police department, I'm dealing with a police chief that doesn't care about my humanity because I allowed a mayor to get into office that selected a police chief that didn't care about my humanity. So I don't ever expect it to be perfect, brother. But you and I both know if something is wrong with your hands, man, would you rather just sit some there and let somebody punch you? Or would you bob and weave a little bit so you can dodge some of the punches? Man, yeah, I'm just trying to bob and weave, brother, until I get to a place where my hands are strong enough to knock them out.
That's good. I'm just saying that if we don't get together as a people, you know, if we don't get together as a mass, that's the only thing that's going to change anything out here as far as this system goes, is a mass of people collectively on the same agenda and moving in the same direction. You know what I mean? And they're challenging the rights and knowing your rights, you know what I mean? And that's the only thing that's going to change. And until we get together again, you know, we just going to sit out here and everybody's going to be talking about what happened here and what happened there. And it's going to go with what they want to happen. I mean,
well, Brother Wilson, I agree. I think we need a higher level of solidarity. I just hope it's strategic because I think, like you said, it's not a black or white issue. We got to get together with the people that agree with the same agenda that we have, fight, push, and strategize to be able to make it work. I've got a couple of other people on the line, you all, but we're going to take a short break and come back to them before we shift gears. I'm Jeff Johnson, filling in for Roland Martin. It's 43 after the hour. We're going to come back and talk a lot more about voting. Are you voting? Why you are or you're not? Did you early vote and how was your experience? You all can join the conversation really quickly. We ain't got a lot of time. 877-373-9766 is the number. This is News 1 Now.
At 877-373-9766.
Don't mess with me on this topic now.
That's 877-373-9766. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, this is Jeff Johnson. We are back. And we got a couple callers on the line before we shift gears and go to the next level. I got Nettie on the line from Cincinnati. Cincinnati is heavy today. Nettie, what's on your mind?
Greetings to you from beautiful Lincoln Heights. I'm calling to say that it's ignorant talk when we get on the radio and say that we're not going to vote, when we haven't sacrificed anything. There's people who's died so we'd have the right to vote. We need to vote. It opens doors for us. It gives us the right to speak like you hear me speaking right now. We have won a race twice. Our President Barack Obama is in office because we came out and voted. We need to stop this ignorant talk. It ain't going to change nothing. Well, if you don't make a step, it's not going to change anything. I am so sick of us being ignorant. We need to get out here. If we want things to change, we got to at least try. Now, early voting, I have already voted. And I'm going to tell you, it was a wonderful thing. I dressed up to go down there. I had my clothes on. In fact, my brother, he's running for the Ohio State Senate.
All right.
So I'm just going to say this one thing. I came down there. I got up and got my shower and got myself fixed up, put my little lipstick and everything on. Mm-hmm. Because it is a beautiful right to be able to walk up in there and vote. So I want you all out there to hear me. Wherever you are, get on out there and vote. We need to vote. We can't say nothing. Shut up if you ain't going to do nothing.
Well, Cincinnati, I appreciate you. I appreciate your passion. And you and I both know, as much as we may not like it, what makes a democracy is the right that we have the ability to come to the polls or not go. I just want people, to your point, not to be ignorant and know why they are or are not going and what they give up by not going to the polls. And so, Sister Nettie, I appreciate your passion. I appreciate the fact that you told us about your experience. Have an amazing day, sister. We love you. Mr. Wales from Cincinnati, Ohio, we have you on the line. Are you there, sir?
How you doing, Brother Johnson?
Fantastic. How about you?
This is Jeff Johnson out of Cleveland.
It depends which Jeff Johnson you're talking about. I'm from Cleveland, but there's more than one Jeff Johnson from Cleveland.
Okay, I didn't know. Okay, I didn't know if you were the one several years ago with Ken Blackwell, that Jeff Johnson, where there was some controversy.
That is me. I am that Jeff Johnson, the controversial one that supported the Republican running for governor. That is me.
Okay, well, let me keep it 100 with you. You and I had confrontation on this radio station 10 years ago about this same process, all right?
Okay.
In fact, it was when he was running for governor in 2006.
Yes, it was.
When you got involved.
Yes, it was.
And I want to be very clear, with all due respect to Ms. Nettie from Lincoln Heights, I'm from Abilene, Cincinnati. Ms. Nettie didn't say one thing about her brother being on the wrong side of history in support of Ken Blackwell with the controversy. So
okay.
Ms. Nettie works hard like everybody else, but picking and choosing when to speak up for the democratic process is being on the wrong side of history. If black folks had been disenfranchised, and they were in 2004.
They absolutely were. But if we're going to let's be totally honest, right? So in 2004, African Americans were disenfranchised in the state of Ohio. And a good amount of that disenfranchisement came from the Secretary of State's office, who maneuvered things in the benefit of the Republican Party, correct?
And the local boards of elections.
Wait, let's start there. So we saw that there were maneuvers the Republican Party made through Ken Blackwell to be able to make things work on behalf of Republicans, right?
Well, you know what?
Okay, so hold on. So we know that he maneuvered. He did the job that they wanted him to do, which was make things favorable for Republicans. We also saw that there was a great deal of disenfranchisement, especially in Cincinnati and Cleveland, which were democratically controlled county election boards. So Democrats didn't do their jobs in making sure they had the right amount of poll machines and the right amount of provisional ballots. And we saw black folks not get what they needed. So at the end of the day, both parties messed up in making sure that people got the access to the polls that they needed. So I think to Ms. Nettie's point, I'm not talking about what she did or didn't say. Before we get out of here, we got to realize that the Democrats and Republican both have to be held accountable by us if we want to make sure that our right to vote is pushed the way we need to. You all, I got to get out of here for a second. We're going to take a quick break. I'm not leaving you, Mr. Wales. We're coming right back.
Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hey, I'm Jeff Johnson. Today on News One Now, a convicted sex offender's confession leads to the discovery of 7 female bodies across Indiana. But his possible killing spree could span over 20 years. Just days before the midterm elections, the Supreme Court upholds Texas's controversial voter ID law. America's wealth coach, Deborah Owens, shows you how to invest with success in these volatile times. A plot for peace. We're talking to the French businessman who was instrumental in Nelson Mandela's release from jail. Plus, gospel and R&B crooner Molly Music drops by to talk about his new moves in the music business. All that and more coming up right now. News One Now. Seven bodies and possibly more to be found after police in Hammond, Indiana, arrest a convicted sex offender. Authorities say murders stretching back almost 20 years might be linked to the same killer. 43-year-old Dion Van was arrested Friday night after the 19-year-old Africa Hardy was found at Hammond, Indiana Motel 6. 35-year-old Anita Jones' body was found in an abandoned house in Gary, along with another slain female. She had been missing since October 8th. So far, seven bodies have been found, and police believe there will be more.
It is possible that investigation will lead to more victims. It could go back as far as 20 years, based on some statements we have.
From speaking with my investigators, it seemed like he just wanted to just get this out, get it over with.
To give us some insight into criminal mind is renowned criminal profiler Pat Brown. Now, Pat, clearly we are labeling this a serial killer, even though we're not quite sure that this is a serial killer?
No, he is a serial killer.
Okay.
There's absolutely no question. First of all, when you have a man who takes a stranger and rapes and murders her, he's a serial killer, whether we know if he's done it before or whether he's going to do it again, because he will do it again. So this guy is a serial killer, unquestionably. He's already linked to the one crime, and then he's given up more information, which has led to other bodies. So unless...
Well, and there's constantly this myth that African-American aren't serial killers. I mean, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and so we saw Anthony Soul just
right.
a few years ago, who had been killing women over and over and over again, burying them in and around his house. So we know that that's the case. Where did this myth come from? That African-Americans don't do this, but white folks have
right.
the propensity to.
Well, I think that myth went for so many years, we heard that. And we also heard that people only kill within their own race. Like, they don't like their moms or sisters, so they have to go kill.
People really kill people in their vicinity.
They just kill who's near their house. And what has happened in the past is that simply African-Americans have been African-American communities, whites have lived in white communities, so they've killed in their communities people of their own race. But now that we have more mixing, we see black killers killing white people and white people killing black women. You know, it doesn't really matter. And the other reason you asked about African-American serial killers, why haven't we heard about them so much? Simply, they didn't get as much advertising in the past. So sometimes when their interviews are done with serial killers in prison, the FBI went and interviewed well-known white serial killers. And secondly, when you have an area, if you have city areas, a lot of times there's just simply not as good investigation because there's so much going on in crime in the inner city. So when you have more African Americans in inner cities, they got less decent investigation.
Exactly. And yeah. we know that there are more unsolved crimes in
right.
poor communities, African American communities.
But
also, let's talk about the fact that especially when we have a serial killer, most of whom's victims are women, these are not necessarily women that people are quote unquote looking for. They may be homeless, they may be mentally ill, there are all kinds of factors. Am I right?
Yeah, you have a serial killer who's smart enough to pick women that if they go missing, nobody notices for months. That would be people who are addicted to drugs, who run in certain communities where a simple fact is people go, oh, she's off on a bender someplace, or she's probably gone someplace with her boyfriend. We don't know where she is. And they don't look because she's done it before. But this time, she's really dead from a serial killer. So they know to pick women who are involved in prostitution, women who are involved in drugs, hitchhikers, anybody who simply may not be noticed for a while. Then you get those who do pick on victims who are actually quite, it's quite dangerous to do so, like down in Charlottesville, Virginia, because you're picking
right.
on college students, and that gets immense amount of publicity. Much more dangerous for a serial killer to do
but
that.
But let's talk about this case, because how disciplined does law enforcement have to be able to now say, how cold? How do we pull out cold cases? What cold
yeah.
cases are connected to this? Is it only DNA that we allow to connect cases to this? Or will there be profilers like yourself that says, does this murder or this incident look like it could have been? And then the investigation
You've got to be careful
on.
Of that, because what happens is if you do not have good proof that the case is connected to one particular serial killer, you don't want to say that he did it because you'll leave another serial killer out there. But a lot of times police departments don't mind doing that
sometimes
because it closes cases. So I was like, oh yeah, those 20
exactly.
were done by this guy. But I'm not saying all police departments do this, but some have done it. So with this guy, he's saying he's killed these women, and maybe back 20 years. Well, he's playing a game. He's going to have a great time because he can now get field trips. He can go to McDonald's. He can play with the minds of the police detectives. So he's going to enjoy himself saying he killed all kinds of women, even if he didn't. So they've got to be sure that there's something connecting him, the DNA, or like he did recently in Indiana, if he can say there's a body at this particular location, and there is, well, then it probably is that guy.
How dangerous is media coverage of serial killers when you begin to get into the minds of others who are out there? I mean, we hear about copycat killers all the time. How prevalent is that on the tail end of these kind of stories? Does it matter at all? Does the sensationalism ultimately negatively affect us?
Well, in my opinion, I won't do any media on mass murder because I do think the sensationalism on mass murderers causes the next mass murder. So I've stopped doing all media work on that completely. That's why I disappeared off of a lot of television because we do so much on mass murder, which needs to stop. However, with serial killers, it's different. They're doing it anyway. So what happens with that is we need to get the information out to the public so they can identify who's doing this, because one of the biggest problems with serial homicide is police have no idea. You know, they got a dead woman in the bushes. You're like, okay, it's a dead woman in the bushes. I don't know who did it. Look around you. It's a huge city. So you need to go to the public, and you need to say, do you know a psychopath who was at this location, who maybe had this kind of weapon, who wore this kind of clothing, whatever you can get out to the public, so they can identify a serial killer. This particular man was identified by a member of the public because she thought something was suspicious. Thank God for that, because now she stopped his serial homicide. So I think we need to get this information out to the public. The serial killers are going to do it anyway. So we need to make them, to understand them. That's very important.
Well, and obviously this also speaks to the importance of community policing and the connection that folks in the community have to law enforcement, because in this case and in Cleveland, there were signs that this person should have been investigated more completely than they had been.
Yeah, and that they should have recognized there was a serial killer out there. But, you know, as they said now, well, there's not a serial killer out there. Well, maybe not now, but there was for the last how many years? You know? And so a lot of times they play down that because they don't want the publicity and the pressure from the public, but it's really important that we know.
Well, thank you so much for coming talk to us about it. You all, coming up, we're going to hear from the panel. Some say it's designed to discriminate, but the highest court in the land disagrees and upholds the Texas voter ID law. America's wealth coach Deborah Owens helps you achieve your investment goals even when the markets go up and down. And we're going to talk to the man behind the movie Plot of Peace to find out how he helped end apartheid. And Molly Music is in the house to talk about his new music and much more. Hit me up with your thoughts, you all, on News One or at Jeff's Nation or our News One Facebook page. It's 8 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
The U.S. Supreme Court decided to uphold the controversial Texas voter ID law some say is designed to discriminate. This means that as many as 600,000 voters, mostly Black and Latino, could be turned away at the polls because they won't have acceptable identification. A new University of Delaware study shows 67% of white Americans support voter ID laws in general. That number jumps to 73% when a picture of a Black person voting is used along with the questions about voter ID. What does this subconscious racism tell us about how much work is left to do in the country? On the panel, George Curry, editor-in-chief, National Newspaper Publishers Association, Francesca Chambers, journalist for the Daily Mail, and Joseph Williams, political journalist. So, you all, clearly this is a step in the wrong direction. Anytime we're seeing that it's harder for folks to get to the polls than it is easier, it becomes problematic. But how do we deal with this, Joseph, in a racial lens? Is there a racial lens that really says, all right, this is about blocking Blacks and Latinos in the state of Texas?
Well, it seems almost clear. I mean, it's hard to imagine exactly what was going through the Supreme Court's mind. And they've also been giving us mixed messages on the issue of voting rights, where in North Carolina and in Wisconsin, two restrictive rights were banned by the Supreme Court, yet this one is allowed to stand, which is probably the largest one of them all. So it's kind of hard to understand. And when you have such an effect as demonstrated by the poll and by demonstrated as legitimate studies that have shown that this will mostly harm African-American Latino voters, it's hard not to call that into question. Dealing with that means trying to either push back, which the Supreme Court has pretty much said they're not going to go very much further with this, particularly in Texas, that's the law of the land is going to be settled, and then just try to participate as much as they can by getting people registered, by getting people identification, and by trying to play as hard as you can within the rules.
But even as we talk about what needs to happen next, Francesca, how do we deal with kind of this schizophrenic nature of the highest court of the land? And when you begin to look at the numbers, that there really is not enough proof to say that there are enough voter fraud cases that justify voter ID in the first place?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's schizophrenic. If you look at each individual case, it's not that all these voter
voter ID laws are exactly the same, and so they should necessarily issue one ruling for every single state. Each state has very different requirements. Now, we're talking about what was going through their head with results to as it regards to Texas. In Texas, they ruled that the law would be able to go into effect because early voting in Texas began yesterday, Monday. And Texas argued that if they didn't allow it to go in effect, it would mess up their entire election system because they were planning on having this law go in effect. Now, that being said, you can disagree with that. However, that is why the Supreme Court went ahead and allowed this specific case to go in effect when some of them it did not.
Well, I don't know if the Supreme Court said because they asked that we're going to put it in place right now. I mean, George, clearly there's an issue here because I think there is a schizophrenic nature of this court that says ID is necessary in one place, but not necessary in another place. What is the justification that is even being used to say that it's justifiable when we've seen over and over again that there aren't the levels of voter fraud?
We put it right. There's no consistency here, especially in Texas, where you can use your gun license, but not your student ID, to vote. This is terrible, but let's go ahead and say it. These changes came about mostly in Republican states, Republican chambers, that put this enacted in the last few years. Now, in the United States, there are more than 100 countries that have a higher turnout rate than we have. We should be expanding this. In Australia, I think about 96% of the public. It's mandatory that you go and vote. And here we are trying to constrict this when we have one of the worst records in the industrialized world.
But how do we deal with, because I think that we saw the numbers that showed 67% of whites, and unfortunately we didn't see what the numbers of blacks are, but we saw 67% of whites say that they think ID is necessary. I think that there's a misnomer here, that we're looking for people to be able to come to the polls and take advantage of the system. But we haven't seen those numbers that don't justify that.
It was a solution for a problem that didn't exist. And going forward, it sounds like, I mean, I remember an analogy used from the first segment where it's like you have to bob and weave until your hands get strong enough to knock the person out. So that seems to be the only remedy here in going forward. And the only thing that can counter these laws is trying to find a way to adapt and use them to your advantage. But also in virtue of the nature of the schizophrenic Supreme Court, it's basically, you're right in one respect, Francesca, it is consistency, and that consistency is states' rights. Mm-hmm. And we all kind of hear that, some African-Americans hear that as a euphemism for something that happened really back, you know, some awful things that happened in the Civil Rights era. And I think that's what this is.
That's the law of the land right now. But Francesca, what do we now do? Right, because this law is passed. It's on the books. What do people in Texas, what are people in North Carolina doing? What are people in Ohio doing as they're dealing with voter ID and reduction of early voting? What's the answer to make sure that there's not disenfranchisement?
Well, number one, get your ID. I mean, even if you disagree with the law, it is the law of the land. Get your ID and so that you can vote. I mean, that's number one. And number two, if you disagree with the law, I think it's certainly appropriate to then she'll try to fight that, to still try and get that overturned, to get new legislation passed, to get the Supreme Court to take up a case on voter identification laws in general, because it hasn't done that. It ruled in the Shelby County case, but that wasn't specifically as regards to voter identification.
But George, let me in it, because the reality is there are people that don't have resources, there are people that have lack of funds and lack of access that are affected by this now. So just saying get your ID doesn't necessarily work in certain parts of Texas. How do we help people get those IDs?
What we need to do is go, like, just like we have efforts to take them to the polls, we're to take them not only just get driver's license, but get other forms of state ID that you can use. Yeah. And in the meantime, that's what we got to live with. So we have to mobilize to say we got to get something that's acceptable right now, and we have to do it now.
So as we move forward, and this is a one-word answer, as we move forward, is this about getting federal law for voter access or about fighting at the state level?
Yes, about getting federal law.
State level.
Yes.
All right. Coming up, y'all, we're going to ride out the market's ups and downs like we are these political ones. Talking about sound investment strategy, America's wealth coach Deborah Owens is here to tell you how. We're going to be joined by a secret agent from France who played a big role in ending apartheid in South Africa. And later I'll chat with one of gospel R&B's new sensations, Molly Music. Hit me up, y'all, on Twitter at Jeff's Nation. We'll be right back. It's 19 after the hour. This is News 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now. with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
It's time for Wealthy You. Give me that money. Deborah Owens, America's Wealth Coach, is here to help your investment money weather the storm, even when investment markets are turbulent. Welcome, Deborah. How are you?
Oh, it's good to be here again.
Good, absolutely. So tell me right off the top, what are some of the largest misconceptions that people have about investing?
Well, particularly, it's investing when the market gets turbulent. So in the past couple of weeks, what we've seen is the market go down significantly. Whenever it drops 200 or 300 points, people want to run for the exits. And what's important for people to get clear on is what they're investing for. And so oftentimes, because we're invested in mutual funds, we think, You ask people and they say, oh, yeah, I'm a long-term investor. When you talk to them, they're saying, oh, well, I'm going to need that money within the next couple of years. So that's the most common mistake, is not making sure that your investments, that you've decided what the time horizon for those investments should be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the major mistakes.
Well, people talk about this dollar cost averaging,
right,
piece. And so what is it, number one?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because most of us are practicing dollar cost averaging. All dollar cost averaging is systematically investing month to month. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it, the average person, if you've got a retirement plan at work, they're taking that money out of your check biweekly or monthly. So that's dollar cost averaging. And the benefit to dollar cost averaging is, even when the market goes down, that means that you're consistently investing. And in fact, when the market goes down, you're investing at lower prices. And so one of the habits that I tell people they need to develop is the habit of a wealthy mindset. Mm-hmm. And that means viewing problems as opportunities. So just like when you go in the store and you see 30% off, that's how you should view the market when it goes down, provided that you have your time horizons set, meaning that you understand that you have money in different places depending upon when you're going to need your money. So I'd like to talk a little bit about time horizons and how people should really look at investing based on when they're going to need the money.
Well, and how do people become a little bit more, because I think there are a lot of times where people get into the market for that kind of short-term investment. When the market shifts and it becomes volatile, how do I change my temperament? What are some of the things that I need to do immediately?
Well, the key is not to change your temperament. So let's step back a little bit. And what I'd like to do is talk about investment time frames. Okay, yeah. So let's break it down for our viewers. So let's say I've got a short-term time frame, right? So that's money like your cash reserves, money that you're going to need in the next 3 years. And for retirees, for money that they're going to be taking income out of, they don't need to have that money in the stock market. So if you have a short-term time frame like cash reserves, emergency money, money that you're going to need in the near term, then a short-term time frame is 1 to 3 years. So that money needs to be in the bank, in cash reserves, or money market, that sort of thing, where you get your money and you have no risk to your principal going up and down. So then if the market goes down, you're like, hey, I know where my money's at. I don't have to be concerned about that money because I can get to it when I need it. And then the next time frame would be intermediate. So that would be 3 to 10 years. That's where you can take more risk, right? So if you don't need the money in the near term, intermediate term, it doesn't matter what the market does from day to day, week to week. It only matters when you need to have access to that money, whether or not it goes up and down. And then the next time frame would be long-term. Long-term can be 10 years or more. That's when you can take risks. So that's money that you have, you know, maybe your child's 5 years old and you're investing for college.
Mm-hmm.
You're investing for retirement, you're investing for your 401k. Then you could start investing in mutual funds that have stocks in it. You can even have a portion of those funds in aggressive growth funds. Those are the funds that are going to be more volatile when the market goes up and down. But because you know you're not going to need that money, you just need to chill, right? Sit back, let the market do its work, know that, particularly if you're in your retirement funds, that those that money's going in, the market goes down, you're just buying more shares at lower prices. And over time, that's really how you win the money game.
Now, what about those folks that have felt like they've always been in a volatile space and have never even started?
Ah, that's a good question.
How do those folks begin, one, to get the knowledge, and then what's an easy first step to begin looking at those time frames and figure out how to look at amounts to start putting away?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I suggest that people do to get financially literate is to start tuning into programming. You know, turn on some of the networks that have or radio shows that have investment kinds of topics. I want to invite everyone to sign up for the newsletter that we have these tips on that we send out every week that show you how you can begin to invest. Now, a lot of people think you need a lot of money to invest. And one of the points that I make in my book, Nickel and Dime Your Way to Wealth, is you can begin investing with as little as $25 a month. You've just got to search out those mutual funds that allow you to start with small amounts. So there are all different types of companies that we've mentioned on this segment in particular. There's companies like ShareBuilder.com. There's companies like TIAA Cref. Again, I suggest people sign up for that newsletter so that they can learn the ways that they can get started. And then they'll be practicing dollar cost averaging. The mere fact that you're putting in $50 a month or $100 a month, you're putting in a mutual fund, you'll begin to start seeing your money work. You'll get those statements. And that in itself is an education, because you've got to be in it really to have a concept of the markets and what is happening. But oftentimes, we, particularly communities of color, often feel like, oh, she's not even talking to me. Yes, we are talking to you, and anyone can invest.
And how can they have you talk to them more by getting the newsletter?
They can go right to DeborahOwens.com/news1now. And they can sign up for that newsletter, and they'll begin to get tips every week on the things that they can do to get started. And one of the things I also know, Jeff, is that knowledge increases your confidence. So one of the ways to increase your tolerance for risk is to get in it, start investing, learn how to, and that in itself will allow you to understand time frames, risk, and how you can get it started investing.
And also not to forget to talk to our children about it and allow them to watch us through the process so that we're breaking some of these generational issues of not knowing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That's something that we're going to do in one of the upcoming segments, is that's the whole point. We're not having these conversations with our children, right? So if we can begin to expose them to investing on their birthdays, if we can invest in different mutual funds and stocks on their behalf, if we can start to have college savings plans set up for them when they're born, and we begin, but it's not
enough.
We
prepare them. We prepare them to go to the next level. I got to take a break.
No.
But I appreciate you, as always. You all, please sign up. But coming up next, we have secret agent John Eves Olivier, the man who helped end apartheid. He talks about his new film, A Plot for Peace, plus gospel and R&B artist Molly Music is in the building to talk about his latest project. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Jeff's Nation. Hit us at News One or on the News One Facebook page. It's 32 minutes after the hour.
So you want the truth? Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Espionage, politics, double agents. Sounds like the next big blockbuster, but it's actually John Eves Olivier's story. His new documentary, Plot for Peace, chronicles his involvement in ending apartheid in South Africa. Let's take a look.
He was one of the first to figure out the great secret of Africa, which is you couldn't fly back and forth east to west. You had to fly north and south. So if you wanted to go from Brazzaville to Nairobi, there was no way. So you had to fly from Brazzaville to Europe and from Europe to Nairobi. So it took forever. And it was enormously expensive when you could hire a plane for very little and get there in 1/10 the time. He started doing that. So he started being the intermediary between key people in various African governments and explaining them to one another. And that worked.
John, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
So how did you get involved initially in this geopolitical move in South Africa? Was it a personal conviction, or was it a national priority?
No, I was involved because I was, number one, a businessman, and I feel that I have the tools, because through my business, which was commodities, I had access to most of the leaders of this part of Africa, and I feel that I had some tools to help a solution, a peaceful solution. So I just do it because I had to do it. That was the reason.
But you didn't have to, right? Because as a businessman, was apartheid South Africa profitable for you?
No, I was not involved in business in South Africa. I was looking for business in South Africa. Mm. But at the end of the day, I never done any business with South Africa. But you know, it's just like being in a car accident. There is something happening in front of you. Somebody is having a crash. You stop your car. You get out. You see whether you can help or assist. You don't care about the fact whether your trousers is going to be dirty or the hostess who is waiting for your dinner tonight will have his souffle going down. You just do it because you have to do it. And I did it because I had to did it, to do
and,
it.
And in the midst of that, did you ever feel like your life was in danger?
The feeling of danger come after. When you are in the action, when you are doing things, danger doesn't exist. I am, on top of that, I am a God believer. So I said, if my time is come, it's come. But after, retrospectively, yes, you realize that you are really in danger.
As people watch the documentary, what's one of the stories that they're going to hear that's most reeling for you, even as you remember it?
The most healing for me is that at a certain moment, in the documentary, the most impressive part is when Mandela made his first speech in the stadium of Soweto, where he stated the future of the country by saying that the new South Africa should offer equal chance to everybody. And this is for me the most moving part of the movie, because every time I hear that, I think, my God, he was having a dream. Is his dream accomplished yet? No. I'm not so sure.
But even as you think of that, what did it feel like to have been involved behind the scenes with so many people around the world in trying to end apartheid, and then to see Nelson Mandela walk out of those gates?
Listen, you have been working for, I worked for over 10 years to get him released. And of course, being anonymous in the stadium of Soweto, was the same stadium I was mentioning about, arriving, to see this man arriving was the most emotional moment of my life. Of course, I have to accept it. And then I don't think I will live another moment of such an emotion. Few weeks after, I received a phone call. Here he was with a very, because he was always taking his call himself. He was not use a switchboard or a secretary. Hi, I am Mandela. I would like to meet you. Can you imagine? This was fantastic. And so, of course, I met him several times. And he honored me, as you know.
Well, and there's so many parallels between the U.S. and civil rights and South Africa and
definitively
apartheid. And even as we look at the election of Barack Obama, people in this country are still forced to deal with the fact that we haven't always seen a lot of these dreams, especially economically, come to pass. When you look at South Africa now, and you look at some of the challenges that they have both politically and economically, are you encouraged by how far they've come, or are you more concerned about how far they have yet to go?
Listen, I am a man of hope and future. I am not a man of the past. Yes, definitely, especially since I am in the U.S. to promote the movie Plot for Peace. I have been in touch with a lot of people, and I must say that one of the reactions of the black community, I was at the Black Caucus, we did the opening of the African House in New York. Some of the young, especially the young, they look at the image of apartheid and they said, but this is America today. Mm-hmm. And I was quite shocked, because being a foreigner arriving in America, you know, America, country of freedom, of equality, the dream of any young man was at that time to go to America, to visit America. And realizing that there is so more to be done. Then, if I look back to South Africa, which has been now, apartheid was dismantled only 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago. And there is still a long way to have equality between people.
But that's why a documentary like this is so important.
I think this documentary is very important for many reasons, and is why I'm personally trying to promote it. It's because there is a message in this documentary which I hope the public will receive. It is, number one, as a young man, don't only click on your computer, I love or I hate, if you want to be part of the future of your country. You have to move, you have to go out, you have to act, and not be feeling satisfied by just explaining
And I think that is the greatest message. We'd love to talk to you more, but we've got to go to break you off.
Of course.
Coming up, gospel sensation and R&B sensation, Molly Music joins us to talk about what he's doing. He's making it work, y'all. Hit me up with your thoughts on Jeff's Nation. We're going to be right back after this break. 43 after the hour. We got a whole lot more for you in News One Now.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
It's birthday shout-out time. Actress Amber Rose turns 31. Actress Latanya Richardson turns 65. And actress Paula Kelly, you know her from Drop Squad and Uptown Saturday Night, turns 71. On this day in history, in 1835, the New York Anti-Slavery Society is established in Utica. And on the same day, white abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison is dragged through the streets of Boston by a pro-slavery mob on his way to an anti-slavery lecture. In 1980, Valerie Thomas is issued a patent for her illusion transmitter, a precursor to the 3D technology. And in 1989, Bertram Lee and Peter Bino, become the first black owners of a professional basketball team when they purchased the Denver Nuggets. Reggae vocalist and former lead singer from the Paragons, John Holt, has passed away. Holt jumped to crossover fame with the song "The Tide Is the High." Tide is High, back in 1967, which was later covered by Blondie and Gregory Isaacs. He released almost 40 albums over his career and is known as one of the biggest reggae stars ever. Holt passed away Sunday morning at London Hospital. He was 67 years old. Now, he's gospel, he's R&B, he's hip-hop, and Molly Music's versatile approach is paying off, earning him top 5 honors on the Billboard charts as well as iTunes with his newest album, Molly Is. Molly Music, welcome to the show, brother. How are you?
It's good to be here. How are you?
I'm fantastic. So, man, let me tell you this. Let me ask this, like, for real, for real. How frustrating is it for people to attempt to box you into one kind of genre? Because I hear Christian gospel folks right. trying to say you're this, R&B folks saying you're not R&B enough, mm-hmm. other folks saying you're this. But clearly, Molly Music is Molly Music.
Absolutely.
And so what does that mean to you?
Well, I could, honestly, in the beginning, it was a lot more frustrating than now. Mm-hmm. I think it's because at that point, initially, I cared about what other people thought or perceived about it. But what I'm building is something that hasn't been. And I want to take all the little pieces that I... that the greats before us, from Bob Marley to Michael Jackson to Marvin Gaye, James Brown, and bring it all together based on God giving me the opportunity to be as versatile and as eloquent as I am in and through music to be able to build something much bigger. So it doesn't frustrate me anymore, because all you gotta do is come to my next show or buy the album and you know that it's undefined and it's gonna remain that way. I think it's just going to be defined as good at the end of the day.
And what are the stories you're trying to tell through your music?
Well, I'm trying to tell everybody's story through a song. You know, it's kind of like a picture of two things that makes a person think of something personal. That's the music that I want to make. I want my music to be a Hallmark card. I want it to be a sentiment that a person says, I wrote this, even though they didn't. I play a song for their children or their wife or their loved ones that's like, hey, this is from my heart. And it's just as personal. People don't hear me, but they hear the voice and the, you know, emotions of the person that's playing it for them. And overall, the heart of God.
So let me ask you, who loved you? Right? Because when I listen to your music...
Where are you going with this?
No, straight up, right? When I listen to your music, it reflects that I was loved by somebody, mm-hmm. And that love is valuable to mm-hmm. you, and not just romantic love, but human love.
Yes.
And so somebody loved you, right? So,
yes, man.
So who loved you?
Well, I have a beautiful family, man. I love my family. My mom is everything to me. My dad, my sisters, like my church family, all of that is good. But none of that would be nothing, man, if I didn't experience the love of God, man, through Jesus Christ. That whole thing just kind of changed it all. It really formed my identity. It caused me to find myself and be eloquent as a young man. So by the time I was 8, I knew why I was here, why I was breathing, and what it was about. Only because receiving the love of the patenter of my brand and the creator of who I am, and that just kind of took it to another level. School was difficult because of it. Friendships was difficult because of it. All average and basic things were difficult. That's because I was at that moment initiated to be an adult doing what I'm doing today, and I'm grateful for all of it. So the love of my family is nothing but a product of the protection and the coverage of God based on this plan today.
So let me ask you this, because clearly what you're talking about is purpose. You're talking about ministry. You're talking about walking in your gift.
Identity.
You're talking about your gift making room for you. But it takes courage at some point. Because when you're because at 8 years old, if you know God did this for me, I'm in this place for this reason, but then there is this very limited view of what that's supposed to look like. What was the hardest part for you to transition from, I'm gonna do this the way everybody else does it, to I'm gonna do this the way God called me to do it?
Well, the pressure to not give in to the systems that you know.
Right, but when did that happen?
Man, I think that happened when I began to operate and flow in the gift consistently. So by the time I was 11, 12, I had enough songs, I had enough ability to be able to express to people like, okay, I'm 11, but something is different. You know what I mean? So it's like, hey, yo, he can sing. And versus him just saying happy birthday, I might just do something that I wrote yesterday on piano or something I wrote at the spot on the piano. And that's the gift that God gave me to be able to shake adults, to be able to say, whoa, wait, this is something special. And that definitely got me kicked out a lot of social circles, but it's all good because, you know, now God has brought it back full circle for me to be able to heal those circles.
You've had a lot of music on the internet for quite a while. What's the most exciting thing about this new project?
I think the most exciting thing about this new project is the opportunity for the world to hear it. I've had good music in the past, but there were levels and limitations to it based on the strength of the spirituality and the content. Me saying Jesus too hard, or just really going in and doing whatever it was that caused people to say, oh, nope, I don't receive it. But I think the wisdom and the opportunity through the cultivation of Mark Pitts by Storm, and he's amazing, that's my label, and he just really was like, Molly, we can do this, and he believed in me, he saw it, the love of my management team and all that, we're able to really create a product that will not die. I believe that this is something that will be just as relevant in 2020 as it is today and beyond. I don't know if hearing, I believe, but it's a dream that I ain't seen yet. Chasing a dream that I ain't dreamed yet, but I'ma meet it halfway if I keep on walking. I don't think that loses relevance, you know? And that's why I'm here.
That's all right.
Yes, sir.
So how do you navigate now between the secular world and the faith world, being bold enough to say this is who I am and not feeling like I got to do one show here versus another show here? I want you to think about that.
Yeah.
We're going to give you that and we're going to come back, you all. This is Jeff Johnson. It's News One Now. We'll be right back.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Molly Music is in the house, and if you're trying to figure out what kind of music he is, he's Molly Music. That's all it is. So we were talking about, man, how you navigate between these multiple worlds without figuring out having, or do you? Do you have a show that you do for church folks and a show that you do for secular folks? Or when you talked about the sophistication with which you've gotten into, are you able to now just be yourself and your show is your show?
Well, simply put, yes. No question. And the way that I do it is being true to the season and always moving forward. I think to keep a hat or to keep another hat is to anticipate regression. So I think the way that I stay relevant and the way that it doesn't matter if a preacher is there or if what we like to call a sinner, however you want to view that, is there. I think the thing that makes it relevant is the fact that I'm talking about something today.
But there's so many young people that want to be in the music industry. And they're not even interested in being an artist. They just want to be
famous.
An entertainer. Right? So how does that balance for you? Because clearly you want people to buy this project. Right. Clearly you want people to come to your shows. But it's bigger than that. It's ministry and it's art. So how do you prioritize the ministry and the art when clearly there's a commercial side of right. this that you got to meet?
Well, there's just one thing that happens to be on my side that is rarely on most people's side, and that's time.
How so?
All I got to do is wait for all that to fade. And I believe I'm still be here. So I don't have a reason to be antsy. I want people to buy my album, but it's going to be there. So I think like the patience and the, you know, I'm allowing patience.
And is that why you put so much stuff on the internet for free?
Well, I think I put that much stuff on the internet for free because I get daily downloads, you know, so I have great music to spare.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with this project, we were talking a little bit about off, and before we let you go, you talked about it being a book.
Yes.
And so what is this book going to mean to people?
Well, I think it's going to be one of the things that reveal themselves to themselves. This isn't just me trying to entertain, and it's even bigger than ministry. It's healing, because that's what we need. It's identity for young black men. It's healing to battered women. It's identity to a lost immigrant.
It's, but it's inspiring, too.
Absolutely. But it's inspiring because it causes you to feel that way about yourself. None of the songs make you think about me, do they?
No.
They make you think about you. And that's why I write the music, for people to be able to have a mirror without having to see the bad parts of themselves. Only show them the good to cause momentum and leverage in a world that is constantly tearing them down.
And the beautiful part about that is you sound good, too.
Man, I appreciate that. That's what it's about.
Because it's kind of whack when you got a good message, but your vocals are terrible.
I feel that's what it was. That's why God gave it to me as early as he gave it to me, so I can get all the kinks out. So now I'm just as engaged in the sonic appeal, the writing quality, the depth, and the leverage throughout the ages, for sure.
Best of luck, Molly.
Bless you, man.
It's Molly Music, you all. Tomorrow on News One Now is Wildin' Out Wednesday. Some crazy comedians are going to be in the house bringing it funny. Be sure to go to News One Now, news1.com, for more stories and updates. You can check me out on Twitter at Jeff's Nation or friend News One Facebook page. We are out of here, y'all. Roland ain't going to be back tomorrow, and neither am I, but it's going to be News One Now, and you should be there. Have a great day.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.